the Brzezinski Chair in Global Security and Geostrategy and the Director of the Middle East Program here at CSIS. Welcome. When I was talking to the ambassador a few weeks ago, I said, it's before Labor Day. I don't know if we can get an audience, but we'll try. And I'm glad you're all here. I am delighted to welcome the Ambassador of the Republic of Iraq, His Excellency Luqman Feili, has served as Iraq's ambassador to the United States since July 2013. Prior to that, he was Iraq's ambassador to Japan. He has extensive experience in diplomacy, business, organization management, and information technology. He spent many years in the UK as a technology consultant. He has a Bachelor of Science in Math and Computer Science from Manchester Metropolitan University, an MBA in Technology Management, and a postgraduate degree in Computing for Commerce and Industry. Ambassador Feili will speak, and then we will have a distinguished panel who I will invite up afterwards. We will have a discussion among ourselves and then turn the discussion over to you. So I give you Ambassador Luqman Feili.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, John, for your kind introduction. And also thank you for CSIS for allowing an opportunity at such an important time for me to talk to you about my country and for us to have an honest, fruitful discussion about what's taking place in our region and in Iraq in particular. You've also asked me to talk about where is Iraq heading. I will discuss where our country is heading on a domestic political front, on military and security front, and also on the regional and international dimension front. And I will try to refute a few false choices and outright myths that are distorting Americans' understanding of Iraq. First, I want to make one important point. Slowly but surely and steadily, Iraq is moving forward toward democracy and toward one country. In fact, the only way we can defeat Daesh, ISIS, ISIL, ICE, whatever name you want to give it, and build a stable democracy is to strengthen ties within our country and along the federal arrangements that are in line with our constitution, which all communities in Iraq voted for. And other courses of action leads to division, distort, and defeat, and that in the future of And that is the future that Daesh, with its divide and conquer strategy, wants for Iraq. Our neighbors and world community must never, ever accept that division for Iraq and should never, ever accept the vision of a three-state solution for Iraq. Recent events have demonstrated that despite what outside observers claim, Iraq is not an irrevocable divided along ethnic or sectarian lines. This is the first myth that I will refute this afternoon. Make no mistake, my friends, for all their discontents, for all their differences, Iraqis want to succeed. This was apparent during what could have been polarizing protests this summer in Baghdad and other major cities. Look at the images from these protests, and you will see a sea of Iraqi flags, no other flag but Iraq. Iraqis do not want a revolution that overcomes the post-2003 democratic order. They want reforms that will strengthen the unity of Iraq, the inclusiveness of our democracy and the effectiveness of our government that is not hamstrung by corruption nor by sectarianism. in a shared understanding that is all too rare in the Middle East. The protesters and our government both want to unite our country and uphold the rule of law. Security forces were deployed to protect the protesters rather than suppress them. On many occasions, police were seen distributing bottles of water to protesters and even sometimes joining them on some of the chants. This dynamic between citizens and the security forces represents a paradigm shift that is representing of the new Iraq. Those who will still question whether Iraq, whether life was better under Saddam Hussein, should think back to how this henchman would have responded to even the suspicions of dissent. In that spirit, let me address the first issue, development on our democratic political front. Almost 1 year ago, Prime Minister Haider Ebadi government took office after free elections and a peaceful transition of power. With the support of the protesters, the initial approval of parliament and the backing of the Marja'iyya of Najaf, the Prime Minister has both a democratic and a popular mandate to pursue reform that represent, defend, and improve prospects for all Iraqis of all walk of life. The government is streamlining itself, eliminating costly ceremonial positions and divisive sectarian quotas. And we are decentralizing decision-making to the provisional level so that local communities can determine their resources as they most need it. We also are addressing the fiscal crisis that was worsened by the bloated bureaucracies and an over-reliance on oil revenue. We are broadening the tax base and investing in all our agriculture, industrial, and housing sectors. Just last week, the cabinet approved a capital injection in these sectors worthy about $4.3 billion. Now, I need to dispel the other myth that abolishing the sectarian quota systems will undermine the right of minorities. In fact, this is a coalition government representing every major sector, political faction, and ethnic religious communities within Iraq. Let's also not forget that we do not as yet have any opposition party within the parliament. All parties are represented at the cabinet level. Let me be clear, national unity requires an effective as well as inclusive government. Whatever their religious beliefs, whatever their ethnic backgrounds, Iraqis want an honest, effective, and law-abiding government. This aspiration, we say, is unifying and not divisive. In order to unify Iraq, our government has set forth a framework for national reconciliation. We seek a fair, comprehensive, and historic settlement between every segment of our society in order to save our country from the prospects of civil war and partition. Our framework for national reconciliation is built upon three pillars: the Constitution, political agreements through the major political blocs supported by the Prime Minister Ebadi, and finally, the government's program that was approved by Parliament. These are the basic principles. Every stakeholder in our society must be committed to national unity and rule of law. Everyone must accept the results of democratic process. Everyone must reject dictatorship, sectarianism, and the use of violence as a means to extract political concessions. And everyone must respect each other and respect each other's basic human rights. Iraqis also deserve and demand security forces that can protect our people from the barbarism of Daesh. As with our civilian governments, our security forces must be cleansed of corruption while reflecting the populations they protect. Just as there must be no more no-show employees on government payrolls, we also are working on no ghost soldiers on our military payroll. And we have no illusion on that. Toward these goals, the government is seeking to create a national guard mandated by local citizens, manned by local citizens defending their own communities. Parliament is currently debating the draft. I think it's done the second reading and it's on the third as we speak. This process has been strenuous, but laws need to be undergo this rigor of the democratic process if we are to stand the test of time. We are determined to train and equip more local people to protect themselves and their neighborhood. Together, these reforms will make our society more democratic, more stable, and more secure. Democracy enhances stability, and stability enhances security. Yes, there are those who say we must choose between democracy on one hand and stability and security on the other. But that is a false choice that we must move way beyond. This leads me to my second topic, development on the military and security front. The government of Iraq is committed to taking back every inch on our territory and liberating every segment of our society from Daesh. We are determined not to coexist one extra second with Daesh. That's the determination of the people, not to coexist. We are conducting ongoing operations in Anbar province around Rumadi and Fallujah in coordination with the coalition forces and in coordination with the airstrikes and all other kind of support we have been getting from our coalition partners. And also, we are working with our security forces and our Kurdish Peshmerga in a number of fronts. But the stark reality is, with oil prices currently around $40 a barrel, our ability to finance the war against Daesh is becoming increasingly difficult. This is why we continue to urge our coalition partners to increase their military assistance. As a simple example, when areas in the highly contested towns of Beji are retaken by our forces, Daesh respond by deploying a wave of armored suicide trucks bombs to break down our defenses. Just an example, these suicide bombs are something like 12 to 14 tons of explosive, each single one of them. Anti-tank missiles are the most effective means of responding, but we are in short supply, and at times our troops are overwhelmed by the sheer ferocity of the counterattacks. While we have a long, hard struggle ahead, we can be encouraged that towns are being liberated from Daesh, and many local residents feel safe enough to return to their homes. Some 75,000 IDPs from Tikrit have returned to their homes since we liberated it back in March. Across Iraq, almost 300,000 individuals in total have been able to return to their homes when we are being able to liberate them from Daesh. However, this only represents 10% of the 3.1 million individuals who have been displaced by Daesh and their acts. The scale of this humanity tragedy should remind us of the daunting dimensions of the challenges that we will confront the Iraqi government, including the Kurdish region, as we defeat Daesh and drive them once and for all out of our country. And that leads me to my third point, the challenge on the regional and international front. Iraq is on the forefront of the struggle in the fight against Daesh. But as United Nations Security Council resolutions 2170 and 2199 recognize, Daesh is a global network with global finances and global recruitments. These transnational terrorists threaten every country in the Middle East, around the world, and therefore all the countries in the region have a binding commitment under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter to do their part to defeat Daesh. It's a very positive development that the United States and UAE, United Arab Emirates, and other coalition countries have founded the Thawab Center in UAE, in Abu Dhabi, to communicate Islamic messaging against Daesh on digital media and other platforms. We need to counter the murderous messages that Daesh disseminates with truth from our Muslim brothers and sisters that speak to the hearts and the souls of the potential looters. We need more nations to participate in this communication effort and to better coordinate messaging between the military and civilian components of the coalition. Because Daesh finances itself by laundering money and human trafficking and other methods of income, we also need to work together to stop these sources of support from financial transfers to sexual slavery. As we look toward national reconciliation and reconstruction, the United States and other coalition countries can continue to help us stabilize Iraq. You can provide us with technical assistance in streamlining our government, rooting out corruption, improving our public services, and restoring our infrastructure. Together, we can address these challenges on the home front and battlefront and the regional and international fronts. Together, we can build a secure and stable Iraq in the Middle East, where the transnational terrorists have been defeated once and for all and forever. Together, we can redeem the sacrifices that Iraqis, Americans, and others have made over the past 12 years. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts with you. Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for those comments. We're now joined with by two experts who I will introduce as I ask them to speak. Ahem Kamel is director for Middle East and North Africa at the Eurasia Group. I've been speaking to Ahem for several years now. Ahem is, to my mind, one of the shrewdest rising stars in the Middle East analysis business. I think he doesn't get out a lot because often his bosses say, well, if you want to hear Ahem, you have to pay. This is a teaser. Ahem has gone back and forth in the Middle East. You were just in Iraq. What is the political environment? We heard the ambassador describe the prospective environment. We heard about a changed mode of protest, people having a different relationship to authority. How would you characterize where the politics are right now?
So I think, John, we're treating...
Turn the mic on.
The little green light needs to be on. It's on the top. It's a switch. Travis, I need you.
Here we go. So I think, John, we're still in an area where we're treating Iraq as either a failed process or a failed entity or a successful entity. And Iraq is still very much an experiment. One, I think the feeling that I got throughout the country is that there is still discussion about what this state represents, what it should be. And an idea that we in Washington sometimes see as a divided nation that wants and should be formally split into three entities is in fact not there in many respects. Iraq is still trying to figure out in itself what the relationship should be between the communities, how it should treat its neighbors, how to redefine its identity both in terms of its relationship with Iran, the US, and its Arab partners. One thing that I think we should be looking at very, very clearly is the U.S. should be encouraging that process forward. the more that we encourage reform, encourage the Iraqis to begin to risk discover a new process that leads to reconciliation, as the ambassador was mentioning, I think the more that Iraq will be stable. Definitely the fight around Daesh and ISIS requires that process to move forward. That's my broad viewpoint on where Iraq is today.
Thank you. And you just mentioned Daesh, which is, of course, a perfect segue to Aaron Zellin. Aaron is the Barrow Fellow at the Washington Institute. If you're looking for somebody in Washington who really understands ISIS and isn't just going on what they read other people saying about ISIS, but reads the propaganda that comes out, understands the organization, how the organization thinks about governance, how it thinks about its goals and articulates them, Aaron is your guy. I'm delighted you could join us. Where does this stand in the process, both of Daesh's goals within Iraq and the way non-Daesh members of the Sunni community in Iraq see both the Daesh project and the project the ambassador was describing?
For the Islamic State, they don't really care what's going on in Baghdad right now in terms of their discussions on what's going on. They're not worried about what the Kurds are doing. They're focused primarily on their own state-building project, whether it's in terms of suppressing anyone going against them, or whether it's trying to return industries back to working again. This is one of the things that I'm seeing now, at least in terms of what they're trying to show to the world right now, is that life is going on in the areas that they're controlling. Of course, it's a lot more complicated than that. For example, if you look at their health administration, they're trying to put out this message that they're able to provide services for people in medical facilities and hospitals. But then if you look at the administrative documents, which have been leaked online and not their official propaganda, they're actually looking for doctors to be able to work there and telling doctors that are leaving as IDPs or refugees that if they leave, they're going to seize their homes and things like that. So there's a different picture depending on whether you look at the official propaganda that they're putting out versus what the administrative documents locally they're giving to the local population. And while they definitely have a control, it's purely through terror and authoritarian methods and not necessarily in terms of the local people's will to want them to stay there.
Is it your sense then that the Sunni population is significantly winnable if the kind of inclusive government the ambassador was talking about begins to show itself?
I definitely think that there's a segment of the population within the student community that would be willing to go on board with it. But at the same time, I think they also need to feel assuaged that they actually have buy-in in Baghdad. If you look at sort of what occurred with the Sahwa movement in 2007, 2008, 2009, there are a lot of agreements about how the Sunni community would be brought into the government, whether it's politically, security, military. But then once the U.S. left, a lot of these things didn't actually occur, and that led to many grievances within the Sunni community, which led then to the protest movements in December 2012, which then eventually led to the Islamic State piggybacking off of this issue in December 2013 when the protest camp in Ramadi was destroyed by the Maliki government. So there's a lot of chain of reactions as well as long minds within the Sunni community. If they can get these assurances, though, that they can be part of this broader Iraqi project, then I think that they would be willing. But I do think that there is still some skepticism, even if they don't necessarily like the Islamic State.
Aaron just referred to the U.S., and certainly one of the things that we continue to hear about Iraq is the role of outside parties stirring the pot, Iranian intervention, Iranian influence. What are the constructive things that you think foreign parties can do to try to promote internal reconciliation?
Well, you have, John, you have two fronts to that question. You have the political process internally, which I haven't talked about, which is to do with a project in the making. How do the interdependencies between the politics and the internal, and you have the fight against ISIS or Daesh. In the fight against Daesh, we certainly need tremendous support in controlling the border, so our neighbors should have a real project in, for example, stopping jihadist, tourist jihadists come from North Africa going through neighboring countries and straight going to Syria or Iraq. So they have to do that. Or takfiri fatwa is coming from some of the Gulf countries. They have to stop that. Or some funds coming from that. So you have that issue with to do with the stabilizing the country from a security perspective and the fight against Daesh. For their sake, as much as for the Iraqi sake and Syrian sake, by the way. This is an issue we ask everybody, that this is a global problem. We need to work with each other. Then you have the political stability within Iraq. How do they support it? Iraqis, with the last election, and specifically after the fall of Mosul, have realized what a role our neighbors should play. And they have more or less supported each other in that discussion. We are now have a much clearer understanding what Turkey can do, you know, for our internal politics, what Jordan has been able to do, and others as well. To that effect, I think we are getting much better understanding and less involvement of our neighbors in our internal affairs and more toward the stability of the country. That's a good sign. So we think that our neighbors have matured up to that challenge. Iraqis' internal politics have also matured up not to over-depend on external parties. Because your neighbor, your community neighbor, whether they are Kurds, Sunni, Shia, others, are there, regardless of who can support you from outside. So I think we are project in the making, and we are developing in the right direction. But on the fight against ISIS, I still think we need a lot of support.
Are you finding that some parties think that ISIS can be useful pressure against Iranian influence in Iraq and can help sue for the kind of deal, a political deal afterward?
John, we're seeing ISIS very similar to the Taliban situation in Afghanistan. And we can see what Afghanistan has led to with this lack of aggressiveness against Taliban at the time and allowing it. We don't want to emulate that copy. We don't want to be a copycat to that situation. We want the fight against ISIS for their sake and our sake, that for the stability of the region and the globe as a result of that. So I think we are looking for a more responsive, mature reflection of what has taken place, and we don't want our neighbor's hand to be burned by the lack of engagement in the fight against ISIS.
Ahmed, are you hearing, when you travel in the Middle East, people who say, well, we don't want ISIS to win, but we also don't want the Iranians to win Iraq completely. Is that something you hear?
Certainly, John. I think to a certain extent, ISIS is viewed still as a useful tool in checking Iranian influence, especially in a post-Iranian nuclear deal environment. As in, Iraq is still viewed, at least in Saudi Arabia and Riyadh and in other capitals, as an extension or an Iranian sphere of influence. Now, as a matter of fact, that's definitely far from true, but it is still treated as that. That goes for both the Iranian, for the Iraqi theater and the Syrian one. Unfortunately, no one regionally wants Iraq to emerge as a strong state. Iran still views Iraq as a weak entity attached to it or aligned with it as favorable to a stronger Iran. I would say that Saudi Arabia definitely does not want the Iraqi democratic experience to fully prosper. And in fact, I don't think that the Saudis have ever made a strategic decision to reach some form of a deal with the new Iraqi system, to embrace Iraq as an Arab state with a new system. I think that hasn't been done before, and I'm not sure it will be done in the future.
Can I add a small point here?
Absolutely.
It's important for our American audience to look at ISIS as a global problem rather than just an internal domestic Iraqi one. We have our faults, nobody's denying that. We may have contributed to its strength. However, when you have a problem in North Africa or when you have Chechens or Chinese or American joining ISIS, that's nothing to do with the internal Iraqi politics. That's nothing to do with Sunni Shi'i. Is to do with a global phenomenon which requires a global resolution, as much as global warming is a problem which we have to work with. I think that's what's important for our DC audience to appreciate, at least, that Iraqi politics internal you can help in as much as you can, regardless how much you help on the Iraqi politics. You have a global phenomenon which you need to grasp and get control of. That's, I think, where it is maybe missing.
And Aaron, one of the things that, that seems to me is when people report on foreign fighters, we hear a lot about foreign fighters in Syria. We don't hear a lot about foreign fighters in Iraq. In fact, what we keep hearing about Daesh in Iraq is that it's former regime loyalists, old Baathists, who are growing beards and putting on different uniforms. Not to diss your beard at all. is there something different about Daesh as it operates in Iraq versus Daesh as it operates in Syria?
Yeah, at least on the first part, it's definitely true. I would say the vast majority of foreign fighters are actually based in Syria. Though you do see foreign fighters in Iraq as well, but they're not really involved with the administration of the areas that they're controlling. The foreign fighters are primarily used as suicide bombers in the Iraqi context, whereas the foreign fighters in the Syrian context are more used in terms of the administration. So just yesterday, there was a report of a Syrian as well as a Tajik who were involved in a suicide bombing in Iraq yesterday, or at least that's when it was announced. So there's a difference in that context. Another thing to think about, too, is that this organization, while many people began to repay attention to it in June 2014 after the fall of Mosul, this is an organization that has had a presence nonstop since 2002, 2003, when Zarqawi first came to Iraq after the fall of Tora Bora in Afghanistan. So they have a lot more history as well as connections. There's a lot more local ties within the Iraqi context. Whereas in Syria, the organization itself really didn't start to put down a foothold until April 2013 when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi put out a statement saying that they're going inside of Syria on an official level. Therefore, they don't have the same ties to society as they do necessarily in Iraq, which is obviously a larger challenge. So I think that those are some of the basic elements in terms of the differences.
Thank you. You mentioned oil prices being a constraint on the military operations against Daesh, but they must be a constraint on everything the government of Iraq is trying to do, including being inclusive of groups who feel that they don't have a share of the pie, but if this pie is shrinking, it's harder to give out more shares of a shrinking pie. How does that affect all the things you were talking about, including the problem of national unity, as we see more and more that the Kurdish region of Iraq is
since
exploring going its own way?
More so since 2004, when the prices of oil boomed up and so on, we tried to use money as an enticement of the politics. And that also increased corruption and increased other type of mismanagement or bad governance of our institutions. In the fall of Mosul, with a real soul searching going on, changing the political process in Iraq as well, now we have said that this is non-sustainable and we cannot proceed with such a strategy of only enticing people through some financial ways. And by the way, majority of the enticement was for politicians, it wasn't for the communities. So to that effect, I think we have learned the harsh lessons. And now the Prime Minister has the mandate to reform and also to start new areas looking for revenues, such as government bonds, investments, and others. To that effect, Iraq has done a tremendous change, a big sea change in its policies for reform in relation to funds and financial and external support with the World Bank and others as well. That's taking place, but I take your point and I agree with it. We need to be very careful as not to alienate people because we're saying to them we haven't got money to restructure your schools and others. To that effect, the Allied have been aware and they are working on what they call post-destabilization projects. And to that effect, we have seek support from the Gulf countries. When they talk about marginalization in Iraq, we say, okay, these areas have been liberated, decreed, others as well. Put in your money wherever you have been talking about marginalization.
How's that going?
Not to the extent we wanted, to be honest, because it goes back to the fundamental point which Aham talked about. And this is an area of frustration, by the way. And this is an area which says to the Iraqis, who is supporting you at the moment you need, and the shotgun of ISIS next to your head? You have the neighbor next door who says, I'm happy to help. And you've got all of the other neighbors that are saying, well, we're conditioning our support. When your house isn't burned up, would you want to have a conditional support, or would you want an open and support? That's a problem we have. That's the regional problem.
We'll get to your neighbors. Ayhem, you're just in Erbil. What is the mood there? How does the situation on the ground far away from Baghdad relate to the strategy in Baghdad?
Well, I think one, on the ISIS front, things are going well. We do still have very coherent operations by the Peshmerga, so that's a positive aspect. But politically, I think we're seeing clearer signs of a split in the Kurdish entity around what to do about Kurdistan as an entity, what relationship does it have with Turkey, Iran, and officials in Baghdad. That point, I think, and the extension of Barzani's term for the next 2 years, or potential extension, it really exposed where the KRG is, that it has disagreements. There is a real political debate around how to function, either within Iraq or otherwise. I think that at this stage, the U.S. can actually help in creating more unity between the Kurdish parties, encouraging reform within the KRG, because the KRG does need reform, uniting the Peshmerga, unifying those forces, and encouraging Kurdish parties to have a broader dialogue internally and with officials in Baghdad. The solution thus far has been to just mostly blame the central government for the problems Kurdistan faces. I think if we begin to have a broader discussion of what needs to be done, Kurdistan would probably move forward even as a democratic process moves forward there.
Would a more, given what we've seen of opinion polls in the Kurdish areas, suggests overwhelming support for independence from Iraq. This sort of reform democratic process, would that make it harder to keep Iraq as a whole together?
Well, I think it's difficult for anyone to say that they're against independence formally, but there are definitely different opinions of when do you get there, in what form, and what sort of a relationship do you have with the rest of Iraq. I think there are disagreements when it comes to that. Some favor an incremental process that keeps Baghdad closer. Eventually, these are Kurdistan's neighbors. You need to deal with them at the end of the story. What needs to be done, I think, is just encouraging that sort of debate between Ankara, between Tehran and Baghdad, and Kurdish officials. Certainly, reforming these institutions, I think, in Kurdistan is key. Reforming the government, having a process that is much more representative, I think that's key to having a more stable Kurdistan, be it that an entity formally within Iraq or an independent entity.
Now, Aaron, the Peshmerga have been some of the most effective fighters against Daesh. But Daesh seems principally focused on Iranian influence. Is there a changing way that they're talking about Kurdish fighters, about battling Kurds, as this battle unfolds?
Well, just like the Iranians or any other entity, they view them as an enemy. Obviously, they're using different types of derogatory terms for Kurds as they do with other groups of people. But I think they realize that they're not going to be able to push any farther north, at least in the Iraqi context, where the Kurds have been able to hold the line since the U.S. coalition started doing things a year ago. Therefore, they're focused more on the broader sectarian issue, I think, because it probably gets a little more play, possibly. And as a result, you see more fighting in that regard instead of them trying to push back into northern Iraq. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that if there isn't an opportunity that they'd be willing to do it, as we've seen. Every once in a while, there will be like a suicide bombing that sneaks through into Kurdistan. So for the Islamic State, it's an expansionist, imperialistic type of entity. And as a result, nothing is out of bounds for them.
Mr. Ambassador, you mentioned the reliable neighbor next door. And the reliable neighbor next door, Iran, is also thought to have a whole series of ties to the popular mobilization forces, to the Hashabi, that is accused of being a sectarian militia attacking Sunnis. What is the strategy for creating a genuine, capable Iraqi National Army that doesn't rely on foreign training, foreign funding, sectarian identifications, those kinds of things? How do we get from where we are today to where you'd like to be?
We talked about the restructuring. That includes the military. After the fall of Mosul, there has been and will continue a significant restructure. At this moment, the end game of the setup of the army is still not complete. We need to understand what do we need to protect, and therefore, how should our army structuring be mirroring that, whether it's a border, internal, and so on. We also know that important projects such as National Guard legislation requires a very careful handling politically and very careful handling structurally as to who do they report to. We don't want to create and fund local politicians to have their own forces under the title of National Guard. So we are also careful to that effect. At the same time, we know that the majority of those people who have joined the popular mobilization calls are doing it, lifting arms based on the call by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani for the protection of their country. And they are less ideological and more nationalistic. And they're also not looking forward for being permanent members of these military setups, but want to do it just for the sake of liberating their towns and then going back to their jobs. For us to create opportunities for them, at least. In that context, I think there is an here in Washington, an overselling of this issue of ideologically attached people to Iran. If you look at the numbers, they don't represent less than 30% of the PMUs, who are the three main blocks who are ideological attachment. But at the same time, these are Iraqis, want to defend their country. They may have some ideological belonging to Iran, but that doesn't take away from them their Iraqism and their protection. And they have political blocs in parliament which represent them as well. So we are talking about an actual political process, democratic process taking shape and effect. When we talked about a project in the making, I don't think anybody has a clarity as to what the end game should be like. As much as decentralization, we talked about, and federalism with Georgia and others. To that effect, the Prime Minister's main objective is making sure that he's commander-in-chief, everybody adheres to his command. In Tikrit, when some of those ideologically enhanced military setup wanted not to participate, the Prime Minister said, you're okay, you're free not to participate, but you don't have the veto. I have the veto as when you can participate and the extent of your participation. So the same goes away in Anbar and so on. So to that effect, the key issues we want to confirm and cement at this moment is that the Prime Minister has the initiative to manage these components to the better end, wherever the political process leads us to. So that's the long answer, because I don't think there is a short answer.
But it's interesting because it's in part about centralizing and regularizing and institutionalizing, and in part about decentralizing, right, giving more local control. I mean, it seems to be pursuing two goals simultaneously.
But let's also be honest among friends. A lot of American, when they talk to us about National Guard, they have the current concept of National Guard in the current US setup. However, you have an evolution of your National Guard process anyway. From the revolution to this stage. We can't go through a crash course of this revolution for us. We need time. We need time, we need dialogue, we need to do it free from the shotgun to our head, whether it's ISIS or militia or anybody else. That's what we're trying to work on.
When the Prime Minister was here in April in this room, I asked him if there are any limits, any red lines for decentralization in Iraq, and he said there are no red lines. How do you see that process unfolding, what the ambassador was just talking about, of spinning, devolving work control to different places?
Well, I think that there are definitely constraints on where Iraq could head, but the conversation is still at its very beginning. It's very difficult to ask Iraqis to do reform on every level and figure out the end state of their political system while they're fighting ISIS, especially for supporters of the government at this stage. This is not the sort of discussion that is either popular or they even want to have. I think in many respects, effort to push the Iraqis closer to our concept of decentralization could backfire. This actually needs time. You also need part of the current areas held by ISIS to be liberated, to actually gather more traction behind the government. One point, though, that I would mention here, though, is the discussion over the National Guard's law. That's a key part of an equation that unites Iraq, not necessarily divides Iraq. For Abadi to move forward with a series of reforms on different fronts, scrapping the vice presidential roles, the deputy prime minister roles, to do that and leave a key component of the reform process to the end, I think is part of what builds some form of a confidence crisis between Iraq's community. That's one area that we can actually move forward with.
Aaron, do you see a sort of nascent Sunni leadership that is fighting against ISIS, or that ISIS is fighting against, as it looks to its future in the country?
I haven't seen anything similar to what we started to see in 2005 or 2006 in terms of tribal awakening. Part of this is, though, as a result of the Islamic State learning from the lessons of what occurred in the mid to late 2000s, in that when they started to go back in and restart their military campaigns in 2012, 2013, is they started to reach out to smaller clans within tribes to try and co-opt them, whether it was with money or weapons or something like that, and therefore dividing and conquering these tribes. And it's been effective in many respects. On the other hand, if there has been a group of people that have tried to go against them, they then will massacre them. We saw this with the Abu Nimer tribe in the Iraqi context, but we've also seen it with the Shaitat tribe in their Azor region in Syria. And just a couple of weeks ago, the Ferjan tribe in Libya when they're trying to do something in Sirte. So part of the issue is that the Islamic State has a monopoly on violence, essentially, in the territories that they control. So it's very difficult for anybody to go against them unless there's some type of outside assistance at this juncture, at least just because they have been able to really institutionalize them locally in some respects.
So it sounds like what you're saying is it's been extraordinarily hard to have anything that looks like bottom-up
politics. I do think at this juncture, at least in the areas that they control firmly, of course there are areas that are sort of in between which could potentially be peeled off. But in terms of the core areas that they're in, especially in the western part of Iraq, where they're the strongest, I'd argue, in part because they're able to have a corridor into Syria and back, which allows them to strengthen that control, it's very difficult. I mean, the way they rule is very totalitarian.
And do you see bottom-up politics as you look at different things in different places in Iraq?
Well, not in the Sunni areas, not yet for sure, but that's part of why you actually need to move forward with a part military solution to allow a political process to reemerge. You cannot have that process while ISIS controls these territories. So I think that's a key part of the issue. Within the rest of Iraq, absolutely. The protests are one example of that the ambassador mentioned. This is very much a vibrant society, a political system that is even pushing back against entrenched politicians of the same sectarian affiliation. So actually we need to give the Iraqis some credit that they are trying to form something new, even at the grassroots. Abadi's response, I think, in that respect has been very positive. That's the way forward, to embrace the protesters rather than clamp down. And I think that's going to push for things in a more positive direction.
So you would see the protests actually as a positive sign and not as a warning sign of Iraq unraveling?
I think structurally Iraq has always had that issue, these issues for a number of years, right? The fact that there is organized opposition that is peaceful, that is constructive, and that is more coherent is part of the creative process of building up Iraq's democracy. I don't necessarily see it as something dangerous. Now, the response, I think, is part of what builds up something much more positive. If the political class begins to see this as a signal that their legitimacy is at stake, then reform efforts become more serious, more, I think, more real. And that's what we've seen in the last few weeks.
We don't have what you might call then the East Europe situation where you have local specific entities fighting against the central government. You have across the whole country people who are from civil society movements protesting against their political leaders and saying we want to stop corruption, we want jobs opportunities and others. And this is in a way what we want to focus on. It is in the sense of what you talked about, is it destabilizing? If we don't react to it, certainly it will be destabilizing. If we do not appreciate it, embrace it, and work with it, then certainly it will be destabilizing.
Well,
we still don't have what you might call a strong state. We realize that. And the pace and the depth of reform by the Prime Minister is the reflection itself of that aspect.
I'm going to go to the audience in just a second. But in terms of what you just said, what are the warning signs? What would be the warning signs that this protest movement is no longer constructive and has actually become threatening?
Well, we have at this moment, if you ask me, what's your risk management issues of those? Will be one of them is that
the IT consultant coming up.
One is the diversity of requests they are making, and it's too diverse. Other is that they don't have local leaders of a type, and therefore who do you talk to, who is a representative of that? That's another. Third is the scale of demand for change requires decades. I mean that. It's not because you're talking about, for example, the bureaucratic system, which is based on the Ottoman Empire bureaucratic system, then on the British, then on the Republican systems of Iraq. So you're talking about 100-year bureaucratic systems which you have to reform. That's one. And then you have a police state history you have to reform. And then you have destabilizing region who doesn't promote democracy. And then you have ISIS next to you. So it's multi-layered.
And there are people who talk about the Iranian influence as well.
Of course. And by the way, we are as much worried as anybody else about any external influence who doesn't help to stabilize our country. And to that effect, we need to keep an alert and be on our toes as who is getting involved and what is the end game. Communication dialogue is important there.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to you. I would ask three things. One, that you identify yourself. Second, that you only ask one question because I've already seen five hands. And third is that given the experience and wisdom of our guests, I ask that you ask a genuine question and not make a statement and then end with, what do you think of my statement? So the first person I see is over here. Please wait for the microphone if you would. It's coming right behind you.
So I am Dr. Morogi. I am a command sergeant for the Civil Affairs Unit out of here in Maryland. I served as command sergeant for the Office of Security Cooperation. And I have my question to you, given the extent of all these demonstrations, and I know you're really, you're a friend of mine, I've known you. You've worked tirelessly to restore Iraqi-American relationship, so I cannot say enough about you, but there's a limit to what you probably can say in public. But given the degree of and the level of these demonstrations, does the Prime Minister understand the need for reform? And if so, who does he have to, in his administration, to rely to execute some of these reforms? My experience is many Iraqi officials are really flat out incompetent. So who is he going to rely on to address these reform issues?
Okay, sure.
Especially in the service sector.
Thank you, Colonel. What the PM has discovered that over the last year primarily, that the change of reform requires a substantial amount of change of culture, change of strategic shift in government direction, and most importantly, the ability of the people to cooperate with him in these reform issues. Certainly, he has the political capital to best utilize at this moment. And to that effect, he has made clear, and he will continue doing that, he wants external support to help him in the restreamlining. He has reached out, for example, to World Bank and others. Workshops are already taking place. He has highlighted the key areas who would be initiating reform on, such as IT systems, paperless systems, and others, so that it become more transparent and more streamlining those institutions. At this moment, as I said, because it's the scale of the reform itself can only be managed based on people understanding of the challenge ahead. For example, when you're talking about a taxation system, people have to pay taxes. They have to pay the electricity bill for the infrastructure of energy to be resolved. That's still not grasped yet. Demonstrators need to understand that they have an active role to play in the reform movement. It's not just a demand, it's an obligation on them as well. That's where one of the other challenges we have, Colonel. However, as to who can help us, we have reached out and will continue to reaching out to others, our American friends inclusive, and we still don't have all the capabilities for the reform. Nobody is saying we do, but we are working hard on that and we'll continue working on that. And when we don't know, we will say we don't know. We are under no illusion as to the scale of the challenge.
Nathan, do you want to comment on that?
So I don't think you can reform Iraq in 1 year or 2 years. This is a massive project. The politicians are not up to the task, but at least you begin to restart it, right? From now onwards, given the current revenues, this is what we're going to do, X, Y, and Z. And you begin a process. There is no other alternative. You cannot destroy the entire system and build something new. We already have something, and it's difficult enough to manage the Iraqi political process. So I think it is a big challenge, as the ambassador said, but at least we should encourage that reform drive. We don't necessarily need to move through a cycle where each and every official is put in jail. I think the signal has been sent that enough is enough. There needs to be some accountability for sure, but the importance of starting this process, I think, is key. And that's what Iraq has taken. At least a body has initiated.
So all the way in the back. Yes, sir, all the way in the back. Yep.
Thank you. Rabin Pasha, founder of Social Development Horizons, former senior health advisor for Middle East Bureau at USAID. My question is to Mr. Ambassador. Ahlan wa sahlan, bakhir bay. I myself am Iraqi Kurdish originally and came to the States as a refugee in 96. And one of the things that has been really bothering me over the past year or so is how we have neglected, as an international community, the real aspects and issues going into preventing the violent extremism and investing in the human capacity development in Iraq, which is something that I founded an organization to address. And my question is in regard to specifically the challenges facing youth engagement in Iraq. And I mean that from both the state perspective as well as the economy. You know, Your Excellency mentioned how democracy is a foundation for stability and how that becomes a foundation for security. But another cornerstone is really the economic growth of Iraq, which has taken a huge hit because of the instability. And the lack of opportunities, especially for youth, becomes a driver of despair, of migration, of unrest, and further instability, and even joining propaganda of violent extremism. So I know that there's two other big elephants in the room in terms of the threat to stability of Iraq and the humanitarian situation that Iraq definitely needs support with, one being the internally displaced populations, absolutely and certainly, and the other one being the democratic process and making sure that people have the social services so that they feel that the state is doing something for them and this becomes a civic engagement and responsibility rather than just a question of taxation. But I would love to hear your thoughts of what could be done perhaps to target and what the Iraqi government is planning to do in creating and burgeoning the private sector, targeted youth opportunities, and perhaps showcasing some of these stable areas, as Your Excellency also mentioned, areas that are being liberated, but also areas that are already stable, like the Kurdish north and the south of Iraq, for creating greater economic investment, bringing in multinational companies again, or even creating a burgeoning entrepreneurship and private sector from the Iraqi community that could lead to further stability.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To reach where we're talking about, the vision you have just highlighted, we need to substantially reform our banking, insurance, make up to date our legislations in relation to investments. And these are all steps which are supposed to be in the pipeline. And here we need a strong political will by Parliament to streamline and to focus on a throughput for updating our legislations accordingly. Another aspect of it is we also need to change the culture of over-dependency on the state as a main and only breadwinner, and focus on entrepreneurships and others. And that's initially taking place. I don't think it's an acceptable level. A third point to your point, that is, you talked about the elephants. You have a third elephant, which is to do with IDP who are young. And that means by the nature, Iraqis is one of the least sort of, something like 60% of the population are under 35, median age of just about 19. Population growth about 3%. That in itself can stop any development if it's not rightly managed.
Could you say more about the IDP, the internally displaced persons? I mean, there are a lot of neighborhoods that used to be mixed neighborhoods that are now belong to one sector or another. There are
we still have a lot of IDPs in the Kurdish region who are from Anbar or from Salah al-Din and others. We still have a lot of Turkoman who are from the north, have gone to Karbala and Najaf, for example. We still have a lot of Sunnis in Najaf and Karbala who are being supported by the religious setup there as well. So at this moment, the demography is mixed. It has its own danger. IDP, by their nature, if you don't address them in a year or two, then they feel that they have more demand than the first day they came in, because they say, now I need to look out for healthcare, education, I want stability, and so on. So they don't think of themselves as in transit any longer. That's a threat we have as well.
And the people who moved into their houses have decided that that really is their house.
To that effect, I think the majority of people, for example, in Diyala and in Tikrit, the government worked with local authorities to help that out. And we have also sought religious decrees so that it becomes shameful to occupy somebody else's house as well as religiously not allowed. So, and certainly by seeking government support in rule of law to that aspect of it as well. It's still in the making to that effect. However, going back to the youth aspect of it, it's one of those challenges which the Arab Spring has manifested to the whole region and told that without youth managing the youth throughput growth, without job opportunities, then all they have is awareness because of globalization. They have very good awareness of what's taking place in the rest of the other countries, and they have frustration. How do you sort of use that frustration? Membership of ISIS and others becomes a channel, which we want to keep away from as much as we can.
Second row.
Thank you, John. Mr. Ambassador, back in July of Fadi Mansour, Al Jazeera correspondent, and I was a student of Professor John. Back in July of this year, 13 July, Jamal Jafar Muhammad, as known as Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and who's the deputy chief of the popular mobilization, Al-Hashd al-Shaabi, gave a lengthy interview to Al-Akhbar newspaper in Lebanon. And he made two statements. Two controversial statements, I would say. The first one asserting that Hezbollah trainers are acting in Iraq to provide training and advisory and within an advisory capacity to the popular mobilization forces, but working under the what he called the command of the armed forces, القيادة العامة للقوات العراقية, which is under the command of Prime Minister al-Abadi. That was the first assertion. The second one, he stressed that the mobilization, popular mobilization forces will move into Syria after finishing the battle against ISIS in Iraq, and it will support the Syrian regime in fighting ISIS. So first, could you maybe address these two issues? First is Hezbollah operating under the command of Prime Minister Abadi, and second, will the government support or oppose any such move into Syria by the popular mobilization, noting that I think Mr. Al-Muhandis, Abu Mahdi Al-Muhandis, was accused of taking part in orchestrating the attacks against the American embassy and the French embassy in Kuwait in 1983. Thank you very much.
I don't know about the French or American embassy. I have no understanding, no, not awareness of that even allegation. As to Hezbollah, do they operate in Iraq? No. As to who has in control, the Prime Minister is as Commander in Chief. We certainly have no aspiration, desire, will to be involved in the Syrian theater in any way, shape, or form. We've kept away from it in 2011 when everybody else asked us to get engaged in no-fly zone and others, and we said we don't want to get involved in neighbor issues, let alone in a volatile area such as Syria. To that effect, I can assure you, whomever tells you that, whatever reports you're talking about, I have not read it, so I cannot talk about specific, but as a government of Iraq, we have no intention to be involved in any military side on the Syrian side whatsoever. Maybe some ISIS aspects, specifically commando operations, whatever, if that's clandestine, I'm not aware of that even. But what I would say is that we certainly have no aspiration, desire, will to be engaged in Syrian theater. So that you need to go back to whomever said those statements and challenge them.
Right here. Yeah. Refer my friends right in front of you.
Thank you. Namo Abdullah with Rudao News Network. I have two very short questions.
You're only allowed one.
Okay, the second one. My question is for the two distinguished scholars. All of you talked about the role that Iran and other neighboring countries play in Iraq and specifically in the fight against ISIS, but I haven't heard anything about the role Saudi Arabia is playing. To put it shortly, is Saudi Arabia a better U.S. ally than Turkey in the fight against ISIS? As King Salman is coming to Washington tomorrow, I think it's very relevant. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, we're lacking very effective and good allies in the region here. Neither have been very good in dealing with the ISIS situation for different reasons. Turkey has prioritized containing the Kurds and leveraging ISIS as a tool to weaken Assad, the Kurds, both in Iraq and Syria. And Saudi Arabia has preferred to keep the ISIS problem in Iraq and Syria and not confront it. Now, obviously, that comes with a risk that terrorism at some point comes back home. We've seen a few bombings in Saudi Arabia, but no, neither states have actually helped confront the ISIS problem effectively. And even after we've seen, a Turkish U-turn, their focus remains on containing Kurdish aspirations along the southern borders, not necessarily in fully confronting the ISIS problem.
I fully agree. Saudi Arabia seems to been primarily focused with what's been going on in the southern front of the Syrian conflict, in particular working with Jordan and the MOC to help out, making sure that those rebel groups in the south do not radicalize or become as extreme as the theater in the northern parts of Syria. But beyond that, they really haven't done too much. And the Turks are obviously problematic insofar as they've allowed so many of the foreign fighters to get through their border without really doing much of the border control in the beginning. And while they talk about this so-called anti-ISIS zone in northern Syria, the reality is that they just don't want the Kobani canton to get linked up with Afrin canton, in my opinion. And if you actually look at what's happened since the Turks started to get involved in this so-called anti-ISIS zone, the Islamic State has actually taken over parts of that territory since then instead of actually ejecting them. So I'm unsure that it's a competition of who did worse, but neither of them have necessarily done that great thus far.
Thank you. Right here in the front row.
Good afternoon. I'm Bayan Sami Abdurrahman, the Kurdistan Regional Government representative to the United States. Ambassador, thank you very much for a very interesting and optimistic outlook on Iraq, which we all need. I want to go back to the humanitarian situation because this really affects where Iraq is heading. I know it's been touched on very briefly, but we really need to understand the depths of the problem and the problem that will face us for generations unless we Iraqis and our friends in the international community do much, much more to help. I think all of us today are haunted by the picture of Aylan Kurdi, the little boy from Kobani who washed up on the shore in Turkey. He symbolizes every displaced person in Iraq and Syria and the horror that we face with Europe acting like a fortress. It's shameful. Kurdistan region has taken in 1.8 million displaced people. Europe has accepted about 600,000 asylum seekers, 28 countries, 600,000 asylum seekers, versus one part of Iraq taking in 1.8 million people. 60% of the displaced in Kurdistan region, I'm afraid I don't know about the rest of Iraq, 60% of the children in Kurdistan region among the displaced community haven't been to school. That's despite all of our efforts, the UN, USAID, other countries trying to help. That's a ticking time bomb for all of us in Iraq. The UN is saying that it can't raise enough money to help the displaced in Iraq. The UN launched an appeal for $500 million in June to see the displaced and the refugees through the 6 months from June to December. They have raised less than half of that amount. This is a ticking time bomb. I know you said you didn't want us to make statements and then to invite the panel to give their view, but I am going to do that because this is a disaster. I think everybody thinks that the disaster happened in June 2014. No, the disaster awaits us. There is going to be destitution and disease among the displaced. I do invite the panel to talk about how does the humanitarian crisis affect radicalization? How does that affect another lost generation? How can we ask people to pay taxes when today we can't even offer their children education?
Thank you.
I mean, I totally agree with our esteemed sister, and also say that the challenges we face in Iraq and Syria is in the IDP alone is destabilizing our neighbors, stay stable like Jordan, Turkey, at least part of Turkey, and certainly destabilizing Lebanon. That in itself, it should be crisis bells ringing across the whole globe, because it's an area where it's next door to Europe. It's also people who have no alternatives but to go through. The alternatives is always the illegality of racketeering or any other methods of earning for their income and paying for their clothes and food and so on. So to that effect, I think I agree with you that the humanitarian issue alone in Iraq and in the region and the aftermath of Syria and ISIS destruction, it needs an urgent focus. You also have areas which you didn't talk about, which is, for example, the enslavements and the issues of Yazidis and destructions of heritage. That's, as well as I can see, is a distinction to, a world issue, because that's to do with irreversible destruction of human history. And I think that in itself requires alarm bells to be read. If you look at the region through the politics of sectarianism, then unfortunately people will be switched off. If you look at it from this prism, certainly they can do a lot, and not a lot, not enough is being done at this moment.
While I agree what the Europeans have done is shameful, I'd also argue that the Gulf states have been even worse. They haven't taken anybody in, zero, literally. In terms of the question regarding the issue of recruitment or radicalization, however you want to describe it, the reality is children are very vulnerable to these messages. And they're putting out this content online, but also locally as well. You know, there's a lot of focus on the Islamic State putting out content on Twitter, but if you look at what they're doing in cities in Iraq and Syria, they're also having these local kiosks called media points where they provide pamphlets, CDs, USB, SIM cards, and giving it to people. And the community of individuals that they focus on most are children and youth, because they know that, they are the future. They don't care about anybody over the age of 35. And that's one of the biggest dangers about the Islamic State, is that they're socially engineering society right now. And the longer that they stay in control of areas, the worse it's going to likely get. And because of that, you know, it's a major problem. And it's not just Arabic language, but even they're putting out content in Kurdish language as well as others. So it's definitely an issue for, broadly speaking, Iraq and Syria, as well as anybody else in the region.
I think great comment, Bayan, on the humanitarian issue. I think this is a textbook example of politics trumping any humanitarian concerns. It happens, but there has to be also local ownership of the conflict. The region, it's the participants, parties of the conflict have contributed towards that form of destabilization. Yes, Europe hasn't done enough. Yes, the US hasn't done much, but also the Arabs have done nil. Aaron mentioned some numbers on that. We have fed the conflicts in Iraq and in Syria, but done very little to alleviate some of the humanitarian pain.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. This gentleman has been very patient right here, so I'm over here.
Khalid Fatah from Voice of America. My question to Mr. Faili. You were mentioned many times to the reconciliation.
Sorry, you raised your voice.
What do you mean by reconciliation? Reconciliation with the Kurds who haven't got their budget for more than a year, or reconciliation with the Sunnis, and which part of the Sunnis? Sunni who is sitting in Baghdad and participating in a political process, or Sunnis who is in Jordan, or Sunni tribes leader from Anbar and Nineveh?
Reconciliation in Iraq is, I'm using a generic term as much as possible because I think the issues are generic. I don't think it's an issue of one community feeling that they have been singled out. I think there is I can assure you, if you go to a person in Basra and you talk to him about how does he feel towards central government, he will say, well, I'm paying 90% of the oil to the whole country and I'm getting less than 1% of the income. So I think there is a significant social contract has to be redrawn in Iraq among all the components as to the roles and responsibility toward the state and toward each other. When they're talking about decentralization, they also need to talk about good governance. You cannot decentralize, you cannot allocate power without having a structure for that. Otherwise, you're creating chaos. Same in relation to political flexibility of the governments and so on. You also have the issue of at what stage of your people do you want authority to be disseminated to? At provisional level, government levels, and so on. Also talking about the election systems, how does it reflect the representative of the people? These are all areas which we're talking about reconciliation in a sense of let's agree on how do we man to manage this country moving forward in a civil way, in a civilized way, away from the gun, away from repression, respecting human rights, respecting rule of law, respecting the constitution which we all voted for. This is a key issue. This is what I talk about project in the making. And I do mean that. I can assure you, no single person can tell you, this is the picture we want to be in and we will be in 5 years. That's not the case because we cannot control these parameters which is surrounding us, which is talking about the IDP as one example. the problems within the Sunni communities as to the leaderships. How effective are the leaderships? How local are the leaderships? The Shia parliamentarians, how much reflected are they to their southern provinces where they say we have lack of services, yet we have all the oil from us? The Kurdish questions as to how much decentralization and obligation on the center or the KRG government. So these are all areas we are still, as I said, it's project making. We need to, or progress in making, or whatever names, labels you want to give it. We are still not clear what's the end game unless we have substantial amount of dialogue. As far as I can see, that real dialogue still hasn't taken shape. People demonstrating is a sign that a dialogue with reform has to take shape. Political reform, economic reform, social reform.
Mr. Ambassador, you'll have to agree you'll come back and update us on this. Mr. Ambassador Arizal and Kamel, thank you very much for coming. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.